Welcome, welcome, everyone. Here we are on our 12th installment of Whitley Penn Energy Executive Profile Series. You have Nathan McGowan here, your resident energy beam counter, and I'm excited to announce we have Jamie Liang, the CFO of Black Buck Resources. Jamie, why don't you give a brief introduction for the crowd?
Yeah. Well, Nathan, thanks so much for having me. I'm a big fan of your podcast. I've listened to a number of your energy executives profiles, so really excited to be here, honored to be on the show. I am the CFO at Black Buck Resources. I am a recovering investment banker, believe it or not, spent about 12 years working at major Wall Street firms, and then I decided to become an entrepreneur, so helped found a company called Battle Cat Oil and Gas. It was an upstream focused company focused on the Eagleford Shale, and then had a successful exit. Then we went out and started a small private equity firm with the same group of folks called Battle Cat Energy Partners. We ended up selling the assets of that fund in 2019, and then kind of transitioned away from the upstream side to a water-focused midstream company called Black Buck Resources, still in its relative infancy. That was in 2019, and so have been there ever since.
So Black Buck, tell us a little bit about that. You've been there now for about 2 years. You know, what's going on over there? What's on the horizon, and what have you been working on the last 2 years?
Yeah, so our mission at Black Buck is really to be a total water management solutions provider. And so the phrase we coined was partners in production. So we like to partner with our operator customers. And the investment thesis there is that the Permian Basin is obviously, if you're going to be in the oil and gas business, that's the basin you want to be in. I think it's got the lowest break-evens, highest single well economics. And so when we looked at we call the white space, the undedicated acreage on the infrastructure side, what we saw was there was white space on the western portion of the Delaware Basin. And so we did the analysis, we looked at the customers, we looked at the landowners, and we started developing relationships with those. We had a long-standing relationship with Chevron, for example, and we were able to translate that into a contract to actually build a greenfield project. It's the largest commercially owned and operated disposal well in the Permian. And so we actually built that last year. And then we acquired a larger system up on the New Mexico side, Cimarex, formerly known as Cimarex, now known as Coterra. That effectively doubled our asset base. You know, the water space is such a unique industry or subsector, because when we're drilling these oil and gas wells, I'm not sure many people realize that these are really water wells, right? Sometimes they produce 10 times as much water as oil. And that water it's nasty. It's hard to reuse. It's toxic. And so you've got to dispose of that water properly. And so it's a huge business. It's one of the largest lease operating expenses for our producer customers. So, you know, you need that. You need the operators who can effectively manage the infrastructure and the disposal. And that's what we do at Black Buck. It's been a successful business, and it's extremely high growth.
Yeah, I mean, it's a relatively, I would say, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, new industry in terms of the last, you know, decade with all the technology and drilling and the water required around it. And are we seeing now a lot of, I guess, direct investment and consolidation and growth in the space, whereas probably before it was a little more mom and pops that were handling a lot of this?
Yeah, Nathan, you're exactly right. So it started as a lot of the mom and pop businesses owning an SWD or two, and it was more of a services oriented business, right? It was spot contracts, it was trucking facilities, it was trucks that the mom and pop businesses own. They were picking up water, they were finding the nearest disposal well and pumping it down hole. And today, this is sort of the evolution of it. We call it Water Midstream 2.0, was the conversion to long-term contracts, very similar to the gathering and processing business on the infrastructure side. So you'd sign, you know, 7 to 12 year contracts, and these would be contracts with acreage dedications, and then you saw contracts with these minimum volume commitments, these take-or-pay style agreements. And so that kind of launched this water midstream space into kind of the next stratosphere. It brought all the capital in. There was a boom in the industry. You know, there were even sort of water dedicated investment funds. Valuations really soared, and you had a lot of transactions done. And then, of course, you know, you had a little mini bust in the industry. Too much capital deployed, too many rosy projections, the development plans didn't play out. And so you went through this lull of not a lot of transactions. And now I think there's a confluence of events, whether it's macroeconomic or just, you know, $80 oil, you see a boom happening again in the industry.
You know, obviously, you know, hot buzzwords, renewables, ESG, in the energy space altogether. And so how is that impacting, you know, the water midstream, water logistics industry? Like, is there going to be new opportunities that you guys are looking at to kind of capitalize on some of that? Or what's the impacts?
Yeah, and fortunately for us, it's water sits at the, we call it the water energy nexus, because it is environmentally friendly in the sense that we're disposing of a waste product. You know, we are a good steward of the environment. We have to be. And in fact, safety is our number one priority at Black Buck. But say, for example, the United Nations Sustainability Development Goals, the SDGs, water treatment, conservation, reuse, that's one of them. I think it's like one of their 17 goals. And so it kind of fits right in there. So it with the environmental story, the E and ESG. And then also, when, you know, any infrastructure company, when they build pipe, they're naturally taking trucks off the road. I mean, you probably remember Midland and the Permian when it first got started. It was, you know, trucks, not enough highway for the trucks. And so, you know, to the effect that you can, to the extent you can build pipe, you know, that reduces the carbon footprint.
And so, you know, who are some of the partners you guys are working with at Black Buck?
So we have an equity partner that helped fund the initial equity commitment. It's a group out of Dallas called Cresta Funds. They've been a great partner to us. And we recently did the first private sustainability-linked term loan, Riverstone. So okay. This was through their credit team, really a unique financing that we're pretty proud of. It's really linked to our sustainability goals internally.
Okay, great. So yeah, that's a little bit about Black Buck, and we'll talk a little bit more later. But, you know, let's take it back to the beginning. You know, Jamie, a small little boy. Where'd you grow up, Jamie?
So I was born and raised in Palo Alto, okay. California. And so this was before it's now known as Silicon Valley. I had a great childhood growing up. So my father was an assistant professor over at Stanford University.
So one question there. Your dad's, you know, obviously a professor at a prestigious school. Does that, does he intense in terms of you and your studies?
He is, yeah. So he's all, and this is for the better, certainly, is he's all about education. And in fact, that was his grandfather's big thing. I think my grandfather's big thing. My grandfather actually, I think when he was in his, maybe even his 50s, went back to get his PhD. He was originally from Hong Kong, but my dad came to college, UC Berkeley in California, ended up getting his PhD at the age of 23. So he was a child prodigy, went to college when he was 16, finished in 3 years, did a PhD in 4 years. He taught at Stanford for a while, but it was always like education was the big thing. And
so when you went to college at 18, was that, we kind of looked down on you if you started at 14?
Yeah, exactly. It was, unfortunately, you didn't have any child prodigies in the next generation.
I don't know. You went to Rice and then Wharton, and your brother hit some pretty good schools too. So I think you guys did pretty well. Because you're just in that area, are you naturally connected to computers and all the programming and all that? Then probably, you know, kids that grew up in Houston or Rockwell or wherever, you know, somewhere in Podunk, Texas.
Yeah, I mean, it's you kind of take it for granted when you're there, but we had a laptop, you know, back in probably 1982. You know, we had a Wang computer, a desktop. I mean, these things were clunky, but there was also this computer we had. It was called Data General, and it was like probably one of the first laptops. We were on the computer all the time. You know, we learned how to program on the computer. It was really a fascinating time to be growing up in the early 80s in Palo Alto.
So why do you think it is, you know, in that area, you're already programming at a young age, that you didn't go down the computer science or programming or drop out of college and do some startup route?
Yeah, so my dad did move the family to Houston. That was in 1991. And he had gotten tenured at Rice University. He uprooted the family. We were too young to know any better, but it was quite a culture shock. And so for whatever reason, you know, adjusting to the new schools, we kind of stopped, and actually we had to make new friends. We didn't have that opportunity to kind of program computers with other friends, or actually we were building computers too at the time, and the hardware and software. But, you know, I tried to take a computer science class at Rice University, which, as you know, it's one of the top computer science programs. I failed miserably. I had to drop out of that class because it was too challenging. And I think that kind of that's why I'm not programming computers right now.
So, side note, I was actually computer science my first year at college.
Okay,
I graduated in 99, and so as a bright idea, I thought, you know, look up the highest paying major at the school I went to, and it's computer science.
Yeah.
Terrible way to pick a major, because turns out I'm a terrible programmer. So I quickly shifted to business.
Probably the right decision.
I get what you're saying. Programming is very tedious and doesn't come natural. But
I got a good story, which I've those that know are close to me know this story pretty well. But so we grew up on this street in California. And next door, it was this really nice old family, and we go over there every year for Halloween. They'd serve us apple cider and chat with my parents, knew them really well. I didn't know much about them. We were so young, but they'd have their son come over all the time. He'd bring his buddy of his, and one day I kind of asked, like, "Oh, there's this computer chip on the wall, and there's a bunch of computers in the house. Who are these guys?" Well, it turns out that my next door neighbor in California was the Wozniak family. And Steve Wozniak was bringing Steve Jobs over there. And so in their garage, they were building Apple computer. And then they, you know, in the early 80s, they took the company public, but they almost went through bankruptcy. Yeah. You know, the other ups and downs. And if my dad had sort of one iota of business sense, he would have said, "You guys, you should hook up with Steve Jobs."
That's right. Or he should have been a seed investor, right?
Yeah, exactly. So
That's funny. I mean, that's a
crazy story.
Very Palo Alto story there.
Yeah, and they, you know, my parents remained friends with the Wozniaks until you know, his parents passed away, and you know, they used to get Christmas cards every year from them. And another funny thing is, I got this invite to a talk with Steve Wozniak. This was after Jobs had passed away. And I was like, "I'm going to go check it out and, you know, shake his hand and tell him I knew him growing up. He's a fair bit older than I am." And I went to the event, and I told my parents I was going to the event. My parents were like, "You should invite him over to dinner. You know, we used to know him, and just invite him over to dinner." "Okay, you know what? I don't think he's going to come, but I'll ask him, you know." And I, you know, he didn't want to be at the event. He's very
introverted.
Yes, very introverted. He's not the most social guy. And I mentioned I grew up next to his parents, and he said, "Oh, my parents passed away a long time ago." And I said, "Well, you know, here's my card. You know, call me if you ever want to come to dinner. If you're ever in Houston, we'll have my mom would love to cook you dinner." It's like, okay. And of course, I never heard from him again. So he doesn't care who Jamie Liang is.
If you would have had Wozniak over for dinner, that's
it'd be pretty
neat. Top 10. So now, you know, we were discussing earlier here, and so I really want to dive into this core hobby that you had that I'm sure shaped your life. But you were a top break dancer.
Yeah, top would be
What was the crew's name?
Yeah, so we were known as the Fresh Rice Breakers.
Fresh Rice Breakers, I love
it. Yeah,
this is something you started at Rice University, right?
Yeah, so I can't take credit for starting the crew, but it was funny because
any old T-shirts that
there
say
many T-shirts,
videos, YouTube? Style. Can we Google?
No,
this?
This is before YouTube. Okay. So
you know, I was a fan of breakdancing, not a breakdancer, but do you remember the old movies in the early 90s or 80s, Breakin'?
Oh, yeah.
Breakin' 2?
Oh, yeah.
With,
absolutely.
What was those guys' names?
Well, there was Crazy Legs and who were the other
Ozone and anyway, look it up. Breakin' 2. Now,
yeah, those were classics.
So how did you get into breakdancing?
Yeah. So it all started because my brother and I wanted to be ninjas.
Okay.
When we were growing up.
Did you do karate?
We did some taekwondo. Oh, okay. And then we actually took we started taking ninjutsu classes. And then in order to be this ninja, to be ninjas, we wanted to learn how to do gymnastics, like do some flips, you know,
okay.
Throw a smoke bomb and start, you know, flipping out. And so we started taking ninjutsu classes, and then we started taking gymnastics classes, learning how to tumble. And then there was this kid in there who was a break dancer. And so this was probably junior year in high school. And then he took us to Sides of Houston. I mean, growing up in a prep school. And
yeah, not a lot of break dancers at St. John's.
Yeah, my brother and I were the only ones.
And you had your handy to go cardboard box that you would throw out. And...
Yeah, the cardboard box. Eventually, we could afford a piece of linoleum.
Okay,
we went to like Home Depot and bought a big piece of linoleum. We would carry with us.
Now, is this how you met and impressed your wife?
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the reasons she didn't want to marry me, but.
Please tell me you did a break dance at your wedding point.
You know what? That was the saddest part. We did not. I did not break dance at my wedding. But at my brother's, because I was always the break dancer at the weddings, right? But then when my brother got married a couple of years ago, I break danced.
Oh, man, and, I'd pay to see that.
Well, yeah, you would have paid. Actually, it could have gone viral because I was starting to do this, you know, it's called the windmill, and, you know, you're spinning around.
That is, now you're on your back at that point, right?
Yeah, okay. It's your back and your stomach. And then my son, who was at the time 4 years old, he runs over to me, and then I kick him, and he goes flying off, and he starts crying. And so I have to leave the circle and go tend to him.
Everyone knows you don't interrupt a windmill.
Yeah, so well, it was so sad. But
he won't do that again.
It could have been one of these YouTube viral videos.
So have your kids like asked you to teach them the ways?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
My wife prohibits it.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, so, you know, you go off to Rice, graduate. Post-college, tell me, so what were you kind of, you know, you went to Rice for economics, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, post-college, what was, did you always have a plan? Did I know you kind of ended up going investment banking, but was that kind of on script, or did you just get the best opportunity and kind of run with it?
Yeah, so I guess in terms of career, up to that point, it was pretty boring. It was very programmatic. I had done a lot of searching in high school. So I'm one of these guys that actually has worked a, you know, so-called white-collar job since I was 14 years old. And so I worked at a small brokerage firm, was able to get that in high school. So I wasn't, you know, your waiter or your, you know, selling stuff. I was actually working at a securities brokerage firm most of my high school days. They advised me to try investment banking. And so that was the path that I wanted to do coming out of college. I studied economics to do that. The only thing was that when I was getting out of school was when at Rice, the energy industry was just collapsing, right? It started off with Enron, and then you had the accounting scandals with El Paso and Duke Energy. I didn't necessarily want to go into oil and gas, but so it took me, the interviews after college took me elsewhere, and I ended up doing infrastructure finance in New York. And
did you always know you wanted to go to New York, or that opportunity came up and you're like, that sounds pretty interesting?
It just came up interesting, but I knew I wanted to be in Houston longer term.
Did you like the time that you were in New York, or was it?
Oh yeah, it was great. It was fun.
So you did New York and then came back to Houston through UBS.
Yep, and then I seemed to sort of miss the big boom cycles just by a couple of years every, as luck would have it. But infrastructure finance is huge today, right? And it got huge probably right after I left. But I don't regret leaving that sector and transitioning to energy because, well, energy's had its its boom cycles and certain. Anyways, I left UBS in 2006 to Merrill Lynch and got involved in doing these structured transactions. Went through the whole credit crisis. We got acquired by Bank of America in 2009. That was pretty dramatic to be a part of. And then decided to go do this MBA program during that time.
Yeah, and tell us about that, because you know, obviously, you know, you went to Penn Wharton, and awesome school. Did you go with the intention of, hey, I'm going to learn a lot, or I'm going to build my network, or this is something that's going to, I mean, what was really the kind of the why behind, you know, obviously going to this great school, but what was the kind of fire behind it?
Yeah, so there's a number of reasons I decided to do that. One is because I always knew I wanted to go back to grad school. In fact, my parents sort of mandated that their kids go to grad school. I always knew I wanted to go. In fact, I wanted to go back full time. My company persuaded me that if I can do this, if I can go to the same school I was applying for with the executive program, which was every other Friday and Saturday in Philadelphia, that I should do that. And the icing on the cake was really, they were gonna subsidize it. I could get my MBA, I wouldn't have to shell out the big bucks. You know, I could go to, you know, the top business school in the country. But for me, it was also, I wasn't certain I wanted to stay in investment banking. Business school provided me the clarity I needed. I studied entrepreneurship there and found reinvigorated my passion for entrepreneurship.
So, you know, transitioning away from investment banking to your next opportunity, did you always know you wanted to transition away from investment banking, or was there a time where, you know what, you're like, I'm gonna ride this all the way to the top. I don't necessarily want to go out and into the industry.
Yeah, it's funny enough, I think in high school, my high school yearbook, senior year, I was most likely to be an investment banker.
Which is, let's just break that down a little bit. First of all, most high schools have like most likely to succeed, best smile. St. John's has most likely to be an investment banker.
Awesome. Honestly, it was one of my friends who wrote awesome. That in there. And, you know, I was close to making managing director, so reaching the top of that food chain. I just didn't have a passion for it anymore. You know, at the end of the day, it's a sales job, but it's a valuable skill, and it taught me a lot. But I wanted to go out and create value, you know, put my own skin in the game, you know, be part of something, the ability to grow a company that I helped start, live the so-called American dream. That's what that really is. And so that was always in my blood, and it was always part of the plan. And it took me finding the right partners to really execute that.
Yeah, so tell us about that. I mean, Battlecat, what year did that kind of all start?
So it was really 2013 that I started looking for the right business partners. I knew it was hard for a finance guy to go start an upstream company. Those are typically run by petroleum engineers, geologists, some landmen. So I sought out to find the right partners. So I found these two great petroleum engineers, Mark Semmelbeck and Kurt von Plonsky. And they had founded a couple of successful businesses, but they were not business finance oriented. And so I worked out a deal with them, said, if I can help you guys raise capital, because they had just spun off of another private equity backed business, then if we can start this company together. And fortunately that worked out, and we started Battlecat in 2014.
And but was there ever there a point, you know, initially in the first few years where like, maybe I should have studied investment banking? Or did you always know it was kind of going how you wanted to? And
well, I mean, in startup world, nothing ever goes according to plan. But that's the fun of it, right? So you know that there's a lot more risk involved, and hopefully that's tied to the amount of reward at the end of it. But to be honest, we started when oil was $105 a barrel. We signed a term sheet with our private equity sponsor in November of 2014. Oil had just crashed to $60 a barrel, and then, you know, it went all the way down to $27 a barrel. You know, we thought that would be the floor at the time. So yeah, it was a shock, and it was like we had just acquired some assets that maybe were worth some money in $75 oil. That was a, you know, honestly, I mean, you learn way more from failures than successes. And we learned a ton during that time. And I think like most oil and gas companies in the industry, we had to retrench and make some pivots here and there. You know, it wasn't going to be lease and develop. It was going to be acquisition mode. So we definitely made that change. And so I view that as another challenge and a hurdle we had to overcome, and we did it. So we applied new technology. We built this cool big data AI tool in-house.
Now, did you have any programming behind that?
I wish. No, we hired an awesome petroleum engineer turned data scientist.
Okay, cool.
To do that. But our team helped him map it all out.
I mean, with your background, you definitely know how to navigate it.
Yeah, it was really neat. And in fact, a tool we have transposed to the water industry that we still use today at Blackbuck. So anyways, we navigated the down cycle, and that's usually where you find the best value anyways, is when, I mean, that's when opportunity arises, not when oil is at its peak, but when it's at its lows. And so we eventually acquired some assets over the next couple of years that turned out to be high quality assets and worked out well for us.
So, I mean, you had an exit relatively quick in that cycle, right? About 3 years?
Yeah, about 3 years.
And so tell us about, you know, that happens. What's going through your head? Is it Battle Cat 2? I mean, what did you guys then proceed with?
So when we sold, it was also an interesting time. This was 2017. To be honest, it was like pulling a rabbit out of a hat, making money in a down cycle. You know, a lot of companies were struggling with balance sheet issues, and their assets were worthless at the time. And our sponsor, this was a good lesson as well, because our sponsor wasn't going to put any more money behind it. And I think it was a week after we exited that we got the call. Not only were they not going to continue funding us for Battle Cat 2, but all of our board members were leaving to other places.
Leaving the equity group. Okay.
Yeah, it was. That was okay with us. In fact, we knew we didn't want to continue down that path. So we had to reinvent ourselves again, and that's when we decided to try to raise this private equity fund. what worse timing to try and raise private equity money than 2018? Maybe now it could arguably be worse, but.
So was that going to be a private equity fund in terms of raise capital, have different teams and assets, or was it really just let's cut out the middleman and go straight to the LPs for capital? We'll deploy it operationally and basically be an almost private equity team backed by capital we raised ourselves.
Yeah, it's the latter.
Okay.
Just as you mentioned, it'll be a sort of a direct investment fund in oil and gas assets, present deals directly to the LPs. It was a great experience, one that I don't regret doing, and spent about a year and a half on the road talking to different LPs. And
a lot of steak dinners.
Yeah, a lot of dinners, a lot of travel, meeting with great people. You know, the capital allocators, it's a massive intertangled web of individuals and companies and institutions and different pools of capital. But once you start understanding how that works, you get a really clear picture of how the private capital markets works.
And how repetitive are the questions they're asking you?
Oh, they're the same questions every time.
It's got to be like top 10 questions, and then every once in a while you get something.
Oh, yeah.
But.
And you try to stay excited and energetic for a meeting you've done 100 times. But yeah, so it's a great experience. And to be honest, like some of those relationships I've cultivated still come into play because my current company, some of those guys are investors in Blackbuck.
Well, good. So, you know, you Battle Cat, I know, you know, the fundraise didn't go exactly as planned, but there was still some success during that period, which, you know, is a great silver lining. But then, you know, you come to Blackbuck. How different is it, you know, you've spent a lot of, you know, your past career in E&P, and then you go to, you know, water logistics, water midstream. You know, how different is that as a CFO?
It's an extension. Everything's an extension of upstream. So I think if you spent time in the upstream industry, you can figure out the services component, the midstream, whether it's traditional G&P or water, even to some degree the downstream aspect of it. So it was actually a pretty smooth transition for me. What was different was, so I tried to take some of the learnings from the last couple of companies that I was part of and apply the good stuff, right? And try to remove some of the bad stuff. And so one of the things was having a young team with the passion and the hunger. It's great to be partnered with people who have had a lot of success, but at a certain stage in your career, it's like you want to have that. And if you're the only one with the drive and the hunger, then you probably need to find new partners. But I mean, kudos to my former partners. They timed it really, really well, and just a perfect time to retire or start pursuing their other interests. With Blackbuck, we have a very, well, I shouldn't say very young, but it's quite a bit younger, you
So, but
know.
yeah, I mean, young in terms of their executive career, I would say they're all early, kind of young executives for sure. I mean, Justin, your CEO, is definitely, I don't know the rest of the team in detail, but yeah, it seems very, a lot of energy.
And I really like that aspect of it. And I try, like I said, try to apply some of the things I've learned. Hopefully we don't make the same mistake twice. Sometimes you grow too fast during the up cycles. You have to right size the company. We've been through some of that at Blackbuck. Trying to make sure we take calculated risks as opposed to just haphazard risks, or we want to make sure we quantify the risk and that there's a commensurate reward at the end of it. And really, what I love about the team is we really try to think outside the box. So there was a traditional midstream company, and we try to apply new technologies, try to bring, basically bring in our operating expertise, our E&P expertise. And frankly, we can, a lot of the times when we show our customers type curves and geologic modeling, they're impressed. Sometimes it's more sophisticated than what they have in-house, and so that's a pretty big selling point. So it's a great mix of people. Yeah, we're growing fast.
Yeah, I mean, it's exciting things over there, and definitely still very early stage in the company, and I'm sure you guys will, look very different 2 years from now than you do today, which is exciting. Well, let's get to some a little more personal stuff here. Now, I'm fortunate. I probably I know I've met your wife before. Brilliant, lovely lady. I've seen, your I think your son, your oldest son, had a gymnastics class with one of my girls, and so I've had a little interaction, not a lot, but so excited to ask some questions here. So, you got you and your wife, and you got two kiddos, and then one knocking on the door here in the next month or
Yeah, that's
so.
right. We got two boys, two awesome boys, 8 and 6 years old, and we got one on the way. It's fingers crossed, will happen in late November.
And we share some traits with, your wife is CFO for energy company, so somewhat similar, obviously, to what you do. So a lot in common. Two hard charging parents. My wife is a partner at a law firm, so some similarities in terms of service provider, hard charging, this and that. So I want to ask you some questions there because there's some positives there, but then also, every once in a while. So, and I'm guessing, and you said your wife is also was number one ranked tennis player at one point. So she has to be very competitive, right?
She is. Yes.
So, anytime my wife is somewhat the same. And so anytime we're doing anything, whether it's, a family round of golf or Uno or whatever, the competitiveness comes out pretty aggressive. Do you counter that at all?
I like to think of myself, it's kind of a yin and the yang thing, if you want to use that term, because I was never competitive at anything in high school. I was sort of a jack of all trades, but I didn't play many varsity sports. For whatever reason, I don't have that competitive fire like she does. So it makes for a good balance, I think. But it's funny though, now that we've gotten, we have a family now with kids. The kids certainly have that competitive drive. Yeah, like with board games and, whatever fun activities we're doing, it gets pretty
I
competitive.
know. I'm like, babe, you gotta let them win every once in a while. And they're only 8 and 6. And she's like, no, they crush them. They'll learn. No, it's it is funny. No, I mean, you know, it is nice to have that balance of she understands the demands and of what I do, and I'm sure you two get to bounce a lot of ideas off each other, yeah. Handling certain roles, which is great. So both being finance, energy, do you steer your kids any certain direction?
I love the industry. I'm a huge proponent of the oil and gas industry. But I just don't think it's going to be the same industry when they're out of college. It'd be great if it were and we had some boom cycles. I think that what I'd tell them, and I haven't told them this yet because I want them to find, because my sons are great golfers. I'd love for them to play pro golf one day. I want to do that. Although one of them wants to be a professional football player, and that's not going to happen. I think we've told them that. So he's not going to play in the NFL for sure.
So what keeps the family busy on the weekends?
Sports. Yeah, we're doing...
What kind of sports that you're...
Yeah, so they're believe it or not, they're competitive golfers.
Okay.
And so we've traveled around the country now doing that. And then... But they're also... We try to mix it up. We think the best thing for them is to have them do all sorts of sports. So it's not just golf. It's tennis, baseball, soccer, basketball. You know, they did swimming. And they do other racket sports, you know, pickleball, ping pong. So it's a lot of sports on the weekends.
Any recent vacations or vacations coming up you guys are excited about?
You know, we did... We did a vacation out in Pinehurst, North Carolina, but that was mixed in with a big golf tournament.
Golf tournament, okay.
Yeah. So, but that was fun because we spent extra time there, and I got to play golf with my kids just for fun. Yeah, that was one that we probably will go back to. Hopefully, if they can continue qualifying for the tournament.
So, do they play basketball, soccer, baseball, any of those two?
Yeah,
everything.
They're still doing
those.
Yeah.
Well, good. So, okay, now 20 questions, speed round here, a little bit of everything. If you were not in energy, what would you be doing? What's your dream job?
I'd be a professor. Just like my dad and his brother and his brother.
What would you teach?
I would love to teach behavioral economics.
Okay. I do. I agree. I think when I retire, not if, when they kick me out of this place, I think teaching would be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
As long as the students want to be taught.
Yeah.
So what are one or two news outlets? I mean, what do you check daily to get updates, whether it's personally, professionally? I mean, is there anything you're going to every day to kind of get your daily intake?
Yeah, so definitely the Wall Street Journal every day. Bloomberg has some good articles.
Are you getting paper or are you all online?
I still get the paper, cool. But it's a mix now, online and hard copy. But, you know, of course, the hard energy stuff. Puts out some good news articles. I'm accused of not actually reading the news much because I've tried to stay away from it. It just got too politicized.
Yeah, well, if it bleeds, it leads, and so it was definitely going a certain way for a while there.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to find that good objective reporting.
Yes, I agree. So, what's the last book you read?
So I'm a huge bookworm. I usually read 3 or 4 books at a time.
Okay. Are you reading paper or is it Kindle or what?
No, it's all hard copy papers.
You highlighting?
No, yeah, I'm not tabbing or highlighting.
No, when I read, I always highlight or I never actually look back at it.
Yeah.
But if I pick it up years from, I want to know, oh, okay, that's what, I don't know, for some reason that's what I do. But
yeah, well, I don't do that, but I'm a huge nonfiction guy. A lot of business books.
Yep.
A great one that I just read was Think Again by Adam Grant. He was a professor, a warden. I think he taught one of my classes, actually, young professor, great thought leader. It's a pretty stimulating book. There was also another one called Noise, which is Daniel Kahneman, kind of the founder of behavioral economics, and some of his disciples, Cass Sunstein, talks about. It's his first big book was Thinking Fast and Slow, which I view as a sort of a Bible for behavioral economics and psychology. And there's I just picked up a great one I finished the other day called American Kingpin, about the true story of the dark web. That was a pretty easy read. And then I'm reading one now called Talking to Strangers by Malcolm Gladwell, about how communication is extremely important in conversations and how that can go wrong.
Okay, so name an event that had a big impact on you, kind of helped mold who you are.
That would definitely be my move to Houston. Yeah.
How so?
You know, I often think about if I had stayed in Palo Alto. And it's interesting because you have these two mirroring industries, like technology and the energy industry. And, you know, Silicon Valley is the capital of one, Houston's the capital of the other. How that's impacted my life, you know, in some respects, it's been great. I mean, I love Houston. I'm so Houston-centric. But I do sometimes think, what would have happened if I had stayed in the technology industry through the boom and bust cycles? But I've loved every minute. I love raising a family in Houston. Obviously, cost of living is great here. It's not even on the same wavelength as California, which is probably the most expensive city. San Francisco is easily one of the most expensive cities to live in. But that really molded me. And I love the people in this industry and the culture behind it. So it really has impacted me.
And so this next question, you know, assuming it's not Houston, but say kids out of the house, they're in college, wherever, you know, you're to a point where you can live wherever. Where do you want to live when you retire? What's that
destination? It's probably Hawaii. Yeah, it's one of those islands in Hawaii, maybe Maui. That'd be a pretty awesome place to live.
Okay. You know, what is one thing you would tell 22-year-old Jamie or someone else coming out of college?
That there's no script. There's no one path to success. The other thing is, if you really want to create real wealth, you got to start your own business. You either have to be the leader of a business or a founder, and that's but not everybody is cut out to be a leader either. Yeah. But yeah, there's no script. I thought there was a script, and you know, my career took me a multitude of different ways.
If you could have a dinner with anyone, dead or alive, who would it be?
So one of my big passions is investing. A big fan of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. So I'd love to have dinner with those two.
So investing as in just picking stocks long, short, or investing, angel investing, early, say, or a little bit of everything, or what?
Yeah, all of the above. I find private investing a little bit more interesting than public investing.
Yep.
Just because I have trouble grappling with public valuations today.
Yep.
But yeah, everything from private, it could be real estate, it could be investing in a private business, or I love all of it.
One unusual hobby you have now or have had in the past, and it can be breakdancing, because we already covered that one.
Oh gosh, I mean, I wouldn't say this is that unusual. I love ping pong.
Okay. Are you legitimately pretty good?
Well, so I used to be a lot better.
You're better than your wife.
She's good, but
she's
a tennis player. Yeah, she can destroy me at tennis. But
do you guys have a ping pong table at your house?
Yeah, we do.
Your boys play?
Yeah, they're starting to play.
Awesome. Go out there and crush them?
I got to teach them to learn how to rally first. But yeah, they were like, oh, Dad, slam the ball on me. I'm like, you sure? I'm like, okay, fine. And I'll just slam it, and they'll try to retreat. It's cute. I'd love for them to get good at ping pong, but I must have been like 12 years old or 13, and the U.S. Open of ping pong, I guess table tennis really, came to Houston.
Okay.
And somehow there's just like this open enrollment. There's like the big table tennis centers in Houston.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly where this one is. I need to look it up, but I played in it. I think I won my first match and then I lost the next one. But like anybody could have signed up for this thing. It was bizarre.
By age group?
No, I was playing some older guy.
Interesting.
Yeah. Maybe I was like 14 or something.
So you have played in the U.S. Open of table tennis.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how far you went, you played it.
I shouldn't have prefaced by saying anybody could. I should have made it seem like you had to qualify. Yeah. You go through all these tournaments.
You qualified and you played. Okay. What music do you listen to in your car? Or is it all podcasts and books?
Yeah, big music guy. Oh, you know, that was another interesting thing about me. I was in a band in school.
What'd you play?
I was the lead guitarist.
You still play guitar?
Singer. A little bit, yeah.
So I took up that hobby like 6 months ago. Really, really hard. I'm still playing, but it's hard.
Awesome. Yeah, it's great. I mean, you can pick it up at any time in life. So I'm a huge music guy. And frankly, when I'm retired and hopefully working as a professor, as a, you know, part-time professor maybe, I'll be doing this music production thing on the side.
Okay.
And So I love all types of music. I mean, we were a very eclectic group. We started off doing blues, rock and roll, classic rock, and then moved into more alternative. I love jazz. My roots are in classical music.
So do you play classical guitar, classical strings,
A little
or?
bit. I have a nylon guitar, classical guitar, but I have, I think, five other guitars at
Okay.
home. So, I've
How
got
often do you play now?
10 minutes a month.
So
So,
we're all hanging out around the fire, campfire.
yeah.
You got your kids, your family. I got my kids, my family. What are your three go-to songs you're playing for the group? What are
Oh
your crowd
man. Oh
pleasers?
gosh. There's always Free Bird and
Are you singing
Sweet
and
Home
playing?
Alabama. I can say I'll do a little singing.
And playing, which I have found is like exponentially hard. Like I can finally figure out a song, but then to sing the words and play it, I'm just not there.
Well, so the old blues stuff, I mean, it was very simple to sing along.
Yeah.
And honestly, like I grew up listening to Jimi Hendrix and Stevie Ray Vaughan. It was more about the guitar
Then
than
the
it was the
lyrics, yeah.
singing. So, I mean, I love like Pride and Joy or, any Jimi Hendrix song or
Yeah.
Stevie Ray song. Because originally it was Nirvana. I grew
Yeah.
up with Nirvana and Stone Temple Pilots and Green Day.
You play more electric than acoustic?
I haven't played the electric guitar in, oh gosh, probably a decade. I don't even know my amplifier still works. So it's all acoustic stuff now. But yeah, but
That's
anyways, the
cool.
music stuff, like now I'm into, like, I love EDM.
Okay.
A lot of different, artists on EDM.
So we have a senior manager in our Dallas audit group that literally quit in the last 18 months to try to make it in the EDM business.
Really?
Yeah, he's living in Austin
Oh
and
wow, that's
gigging
awesome.
and stuff. So
I gotta check out some of his
DJ,
tracks.
no, DCPA is his name.
I gotta check out some
Yeah,
of his music.
DCPA. He's on the
DCPA.
Apple. So there you
Okay,
go. I just got
I'm
you
gonna
a few
check out
more.
his tunes. Yeah.
But no, I
Shameless
love people that
plug.
have, that's right, that have passions like that. That's kind of
Yeah, I'd
fun.
love to do that. So, anyways, all types of music, really. Like, I went through my hip hop phase and still, yeah, put on classical music every now and then.
What do your kids listen to? 8 and 6.
They start on classical music. Actually, we really like Broadway music,
Okay,
which
like
is funny.
do you listen to the Hamilton soundtrack?
Hamilton, we've listened to Hamilton. We really like the Dear Evan Hansen music. My wife loves Wicked. And
Okay, so who in the industry has made the greatest impression on you?
yeah, great question. So I would lean on one of my mentors. I consider her a mentor, but Janet Clark was the former CFO of Marathon and former investment banker, and she's just been a great mentor for me.
How'd you get to know her?
I think it was through, she was both a member of the Harvard Club here in Houston and the Wharton Club, and my wife's on the board of the Harvard Club, and I was active in the Wharton Club in Houston. So I
Okay.
think she used to host the holiday party for us. Another oil and gas professional I have a ton of respect for is Eric Mullins, who founded Lime Rock Resources. Just a great individual.
Okay, you're obviously you and your wife have quite the school pedigrees, Harvard, Wharton, Rice, and so you have kids that are come up and. Obviously, they got some big shoes to fill. So, name, do you guys have any career that you wouldn't want them to have?
Yeah.
We always joke because I bill time. I'm a CPA, and my wife bills time attorney. So we're like, anything you don't have to bill hours, go do that.
Yeah, that's probably a good answer. I might have to copy that one. But I would say we have really no limits or restrictions on them, other than they have to provide for their own families. And honestly, they're kind of growing up with a lot of privilege, we feel like. And so if they want to live that kind of lifestyle, they're gonna have to make their own money.
Yeah.
So,
No, I mean, my big thing is happy and self-sufficient. As
yes,
long as you're happy and self-sufficient,
I would agree
I
with
don't really
that.
care what you
Yeah,
do.
that's right.
But self-sufficient's a
Yeah.
big key.
No, and I'm not too worried about them. They're great. And honestly, I'd love it if they played professional sports, but also if they became a doctor, doesn't really matter.
Nothing's off limits. Okay. What is the most useless talent you have?
I think probably the most useless is that I've always been really flexible.
Okay.
So double jointed, and I mean, it. I can kind of do the splits almost.
And, okay.
And it's like, I used to even think
at,
it was...
Even at a spry 41.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
Wow, and, that's impressive. So are you doing backflips with your kids at gymnastics?
I can't
stuff?
Do... I'm scared to do the backflips anymore, but I would say it's useless because I used to think it was useful. It would help with sports, but you know, my body's getting old now, and it's like I've gotten injured, and I'm like, what good is being flexible?
I bet really? It makes one hell of a flying squirrel into the pool. Okay, you and your wife watch much TV? Binging anything these days? Any of these series?
Sadly, we've been binging Ozark.
Okay.
On Netflix.
We've done that one.
And then I've signed off of the Bachelor series because we've watched that for many years. And she's now on this Bachelor in Paradise, and I can't.
At this point, it's decades. It's just been going on forever.
Yeah, so I can't do that anymore. But we'll do. We love like Law and Order. We'll still watch some of that.
Do you ever? You need to get into Ted Lasso.
Okay.
You haven't done Ted Lasso. That's... Greatest series on this earth.
Okay.
And one of the few these days that's actually like not dark and twisted.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's a good comedy.
Yeah, we'll have to check that out.
What about podcasts? Is there anything you listen to where you get, you know, whether it's I know Malcolm Gladwell has a few, but anything you intake that you feel like is pretty good content?
Oh, yeah. So, love all the entrepreneur stuff. NPR puts out How I Built This with Guy Raz.
Yep, I listened to that one. That one's pretty good.
Freakonomics. Planet Money is another NPR podcast that's pretty good. There's this podcast called Masters in Business by Barry Ritholtz on... They have some great investing podcasts there. And then I've recently got into some of the venture investing ones. Jason Calacanis has this great one called This Week in Startups. It's been going on for a while. And then he also has his group podcast called All In that he hosts. Those are two really entertaining ones.
Have you ever looked into the Ham, Houston Angel Network?
Yeah. In fact, I used to be pretty well connected over there. Okay. Actually, I do some angel investing on the side, and there's some interesting startups.
Yeah, I joined about 12 months ago. Haven't been as many meetings as I'd like to.
Yeah.
But, it's interesting. They get some good groups that come through there.
Yeah.
A lot of good folks. Okay, what movie can you watch over again and not get tired of?
I could watch I'm a finance nerd. I could watch... Wall Street.
And, the original?
Yes, the original Wall Street. Not the new one with is Shia LaBeouf in there.
Yeah.
I couldn't watch that one over and over. But certainly Charlie Sheen, Wall Street. I could watch all the Star Wars movies over and over again.
Okay.
The originals.
The original three. Yes. If you could turn back the time and change one decision that you've made, what decision would that be?
You know, my answer is none. And I hate to sound cliche about it, but I actually, one of my philosophies is I have no regrets in life. So I wouldn't change anything.
Except not break dancing at that last wedding.
There you go. Yeah, there you go. That's one. At my own wedding.
That's at your own wedding. That's right.
That's right.
Okay. Who should we have next on the podcast?
Yeah. So as I was thinking about this, have you guys talked to... and I haven't talked to him in a while, but Carl Brunsicki.
You know what? I've met him several times through WAPT, but no, he is a character.
He's got a good story. He's a character. He's always entertaining when he
speaks. Yeah. No, that would be...
And I'm going to give a shout-out to Danny Savitz, who's a close friend of mine, CFO of Verdun Oil and Gas. He has a good story. They've built a great company over there at Verdun.
Massive.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, that's all we have, and I appreciate you spending some time with us, Jamie. And you know, maybe we'll have to have you back on part two down the road. But thank you so much. That's it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.